We'll call the meeting to order. Welcome. We don't have a quorum yet, so we can't take any action, but we can begin to hear Representative Simon's bill, House File 799, on the national popular vote. Representative Simon?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll move that House File 799 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register.
I don't think we can.
Oh, that's right. We don't have a quorum yet. Well, that would have been my motion had we had a quorum. Members, most people don't think it's right for the world's greatest democracy that the second place vote getter could be president of the United States, much less the third place vote getter. And that's really the bottom line of this bill. I think often when we talk about the Electoral College or national popular vote, we tend to overanalyze. To me, I'd rather reduce it to its essential, which is the number one vote getter should win an election, especially for the leader of the free world, especially for President of the United States. And this isn't about Bush versus Gore, nor is it about Kerry versus Bush, which, by the way, was 50,000 votes away, Ohio votes away from being the same exact result. It's really about a fundamental principle of fairness. And some of you have heard me tell the story, but I think it bears repeating about my own experience and what drew me to this issue. It was long before, at least as far as I know, this proposal was ever around. So in 1992, I moved to Little Rock, Arkansas, and I worked on the Clinton-Gore campaign at the national headquarters. And I remember one time, when I came on board, by the way, in early June, Bill Clinton was in third place. Ross Perot was in first place in the polls. George H.W. Bush was in second place, and Bill Clinton was lagging behind at third. He had just come out of a bruising Democratic primary. No one knew him. He had a little baggage, I think it's fair to say, and he was in third place. And I remember being at a local campaign watering hole in downtown Little Rock, Arkansas, called Your Mama's, which is still there, by the way. And we were eating at Your Mama's, and I was sitting with a bunch of people around the table from the Clinton campaign, and they were laughing and whooping it up because of some punditry at the time, saying that even if Bill Clinton took third place, he would be president of the United States. Why? Because if he took third place, there would be likely no candidate to get 270 electoral votes. And if you dust off your civics memories, if no one gets to 270, it goes to the House of Representatives. And the House of Representatives in 1992 was firmly in Democratic hands. 2 years later, of course, Newt Gingrich would change all that, and the Republicans would take control. But in 92, it was a big Democratic majorities in the House. And they were laughing and knee-slapping about how this was great. It's a can't-lose because if it stayed a vigorous three-way race, our guy would win, even though he would take third place. And I remember being appalled. I mean, I was as partisan a Clinton supporter as anyone. I had moved and uprooted my life to move down there. But I was appalled by the idea that anyone but the first-place candidate could be president of the United States. And so when this idea came along, and as it's gained steam nationally, and now passed a number of states, 9 states with 12 more poised to do so in the next couple of years, I really listened. So this bill would simply award Minnesota's electoral votes to the winner of the national popular vote, but only if other states agreed to do the same. We're not jumping off a cliff alone here. It's a state compact, and compacts are something that are mentioned in the Constitution. We do it all the time. We have the Great Lakes Compact and all sorts of compacts that Minnesota's allowed, and we can leave the compact. We can ditch it at any time. And it's a compact among states that says if enough states whose electoral votes add up to 270, which of course is the majority, if they all agree, and only then, we will agree that we'll cast our votes for president, our electoral votes, for the winner of the national popular vote. So that's what the bill does. And I just one piece of constitutional kind of history or analysis that's really, really important here. Because I hear people from time to time saying, well, I don't want to mess with what the framers or what the founding fathers wanted to do here. Keep in mind, the framers and the founding fathers created this thing called the Electoral College, and they explicitly said, hey, states, you get these things called electoral votes. You can allocate them any way you wish. They didn't say which way they had to be allocated. It just so happens over time, it's evolved that 48 states do it on a winner-take-all basis. Only Maine and Nebraska do it otherwise by congressional district, but 48 states have done that over time, organically on their own. Had the framers wanted it that way, they could have and would have said so. They would have said you must allocate them based on who wins your state by one vote. They didn't. They said, states, you can allocate it on any basis that you want. So, as absurd as it sounds, if we wanted to, we could allocate our votes in Minnesota, our 10 electoral votes, on the basis of who the tallest candidate is, or whose name has the most vowels in it, or some other absurd criterion. We don't do that, obviously, nor would we. But the point is, we have the freedom to allocate them on whatever basis we want, and that is what the framers wanted, because they said so. And I would say, as an aside, they didn't contemplate political parties either. George Washington, of course, famously talked about factionalism and warned against political parties in his farewell address. So this sort of interstate compact is common. Again, we can opt out or opt in anytime we want. It's only if 270 electoral votes worth of states pass this. And I really do think it means that all votes would matter equally. Right now, as we all know, about 90% of campaign activity, and you have a handout, I think, that's either in your packets or coming around right now, 90% of campaign activity in a presidential election is in a real handful of states. I used to say 15. That's no longer true anymore. It's more like 7 or 8 or 9 states, and the handout that you have or soon will have will show that. And so right now, we really have an unbalanced system and one that really distorts some policy objectives, too. It's no secret that incumbent presidents of the United States, be they Barack Obama or George W. Bush or anyone else contemplating a run for a second term, will inevitably, even if they don't realize it and don't admit to it, make decisions or not make decisions based not necessarily or first and foremost what's best for the country, but I would say on some discrete issues, what will get them Florida or what will get them Pennsylvania, and often in ways that counteract their philosophical bent. I remember talking with a conservative Republican at one point, I think he may be in the room, who said that one of the reasons he, as a conservative Republican, supports it is because he thought that George W. Bush made some decisions during his first term that were clearly not conservative, like erecting steel tariffs in order to get Pennsylvania, or enacting Medicare Part D, which is a huge explosion in entitlements from a conservative Republican standpoint. Why? Probably to get Florida. I mean, I hate to be totally cynical. I'm sure there were other reasons that coexisted with that, but certainly prominent among them, I'm sure, were individual electoral politics. And I'm sure on the progressive side of the ledger there's similar distortion as well. I don't mean to pick on President Bush, but that's what this one conservative Republican who I think is in the room told me. So, you know, with national popular votes, the candidates would campaign vigorously all over the country. And I would only ask members this one other question. If we were starting over in Minnesota, would we ever concoct a system, an electoral vote type system in Minnesota? What if we did it by county? And just to make it easy, the math easy, let's say we had 100 electoral votes in Minnesota, and we did this all by county instead of by state on the federal level. Well, if you win Hennepin County, and let's say 51 Minnesota electoral votes gets you to be governor, obviously a majority of 100. If you win Hennepin County, you're almost a quarter there, or you're almost a half there, I should say. You probably get about 23 or 24 Minnesota electoral votes, because almost a quarter of Minnesotans live in Hennepin County. So you get 22, 23, 24 right away. You win Ramsey and a couple other, and that's it. We would never think to concoct such a situation. I understand the argument that states are different and were at the time of the founding, but I would just say that the founders wisely and consciously said that states can allocate electoral votes in any manner they wish. As I said earlier, we could pick the tallest candidate, the one with the, you know, with the longest name. We could do anything we wanted, and that was expressly contemplated. And this is a way to ensure, and I'll come back to first principles and then let Representative Garofalo, who's been my partner in this for a number of years, speak. But we tend to sort of overanalyze this sometimes. To me, I think the less analysis, the better in this sense. It's really about making sure, as the world's self-styled number one exporter of democracy, whether it's our military forces in Afghanistan or in Iraq teaching school children about what the United States and democracy is like, whether it's a Peace Corps volunteer or a USAID worker in areas that have not exactly been blessed with a history of democracy, how do you explain to the 8-year-old Afghan girl or the 11-year-old Iraqi boy, you see, when we vote for President of the United States, sometimes the second place winner wins the election. By the time you're explaining, I don't think it makes much sense, though I understand and respect some of the historical arguments. I think the better way, and the way that 9 states so far with another 12, I think, soon to follow, 12 states have already passed it so far, in one legislative chamber, at least one legislative chamber, I think the way is to make sure that all votes count, we honor all votes equally, and that we ensure that the first place vote getter for President of the United States will always be the winner.
Representative Garofalo.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm happy to be here with my friend Representative Simon and co-sponsoring this bill. And the most important thing people need to know about this bill is it has this absolutely outrageous belief that the candidate who gets the most votes should win. Not particularly controversial or provocative, but that's what this bill does. There are a couple of myths that I want to dispel with this legislation. One of them is that somehow this bill is anti-states' rights or somehow is not consistent with what our founders wanted. Madam Chair, members of the committee, that is a complete load of crap. There's no better way to describe it than that. First of all, nowhere in the Constitution, nowhere in the discussions of the creation of the Electoral College, that our founders ever mandate, create, and imply that we've been mandated a winner-take-all system. And that's really where the problem originates right now, is in the winner-take-all allocation of electoral votes. It's up to the states. The states can decide. Minnesota can join this compact. At a certain time, we are frozen into the compact, so people don't get any ideas of jumping in or out right before the election or right after the allocation of electoral votes. But we are free to join this compact and leave this compact anytime we want. And as Representative Simon mentioned, it's only active once we're at 270 electoral votes. A second thing to point out is statistically, if you take a look at this, just from a, it's good policy, it's good government, but people have the mistaken belief that because of the result of the 2000 presidential election, somehow the Electoral College provides a benefit to a Republican candidate versus a Democrat candidate. This is simply mathematically and statistically not true. In fact, when you take a look at the makeup of the electorate and you take a look at the composition, it is actually more likely that a Democrat would win the Electoral College and lose the popular vote. As Representative Simon mentioned, almost came very close in the 2004 election. And then third and finally, just from a policy standpoint, it's important to recognize how the Electoral College currently distorts our system. Electoral votes are allocated not on the basis of citizens, but on residents. So immigrants, whether legal or illegal, are included in the population apportionment used to determine Electoral College votes. So the effect of this is that the Electoral College is shifting voting strength and voting power towards states which disproportionately have high amounts of non-citizen residents. This works in favor of certain states, such as California, Texas, and the Southwest. It works against states in the upper Midwest and really is against the premise of having one man and one vote. So the final point I'd like to make is that there's been discussion before about large states versus small states, that somehow this plan would hurt small states. To the contrary, the current system hurts small states. With the possible exception of New Hampshire, none of the small states in our nation are even acknowledged by presidential campaigns. And I think it's important. This is a good step forward. I'm happy to sit here with my my friend of 9 years, Representative Simon, in support of this legislation and answer any questions. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo. And Representative Simon, I see we have a quorum now, so if you'd like, you can move your bill. And
thank you, Madam Chair. I'll move that House File 799 be recommended pass and re-referred to the General Register.
Additionally, since we're doing a quick, brief bit of housekeeping, we have minutes from our last two meetings that need to be moved, if somebody would like to make a motion.
Madam Chair, I'll move the meeting minutes from February 26th and February 21st.
All those in favor, say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you for taking that time. At this time, do you have another person who you'd like to speak on this bill so we can take questions?
Although I should point out, I do have with me from the National Popular Vote Organization to answer some technical questions or maybe historical questions or other, Mr. Barry Fadham, who's here in the audience, if need be. He didn't need to affirmatively testify, but he's here to answer questions.
Sorry.
No other formal testifiers.
Excellent. Are there any questions from committee members? Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, I just have a couple questions. Back in 1968 and also in 2000, we had, are there only two times that I'm aware of that we've had presidential candidates from Minnesota? Both of them lost. Both of them lost the popular vote and the Electoral College. 1968, Humphrey ran, but the bigger one in 2000, I believe it was Walter Mondale, ran and lost to Ronald Reagan. And that year, by the popular vote, Ronald Reagan won every state except for Minnesota and Washington, D.C., I believe. Mm-hmm. Now, if we went with this deal, our own person candidate from Minnesota would have not received any electoral votes from Minnesota. Although I did not vote for, first year I was able to vote, and I did not vote for Walter Mondale that year, but he did win Minnesota. I don't think it'd be right to let other states pick who we send our elect our delegates to vote for. How would you be able to answer that if we had another candidate from Minnesota and he didn't win? How would that look if the candidate's own state would not give him his delegates?
Representative Grappolo
and Representative Johnson, it's a fair question. I think the important thing is that the more overriding concern is going to be did the candidate from Minnesota win? Did they get more votes than any other candidate? Under this compact, should it be enacted, and I want to emphasize this again, that we would have to have 270 electoral votes for the nation to take place. Under your hypothetical, if it wasn't enacted, if it wasn't statewide or nationwide, of 270 or more electoral votes, no changes would take place. But under the current system right now, imagine the opposite happened. Imagine the candidate from Minnesota won Minnesota, one more votes than any of the other candidates in the nation, but in fact, because of this electoral system, ended up not becoming elected president. Imagine that scenario. And so while I think your concern is reasonable from a heartfelt standpoint, the reality is we want a system where the candidate who gets the most votes wins, not the candidate necessarily who's from Minnesota or not.
Representative Simon.
I would only say thank you. And Representative Johnson, I would say that you know, while it would certainly be a wounding to the pride of, I guess, some Minnesotans and certainly the candidate from Minnesota, I sort of look at it as, well, especially with a presidential election, a national election, I sort of think of it as, I think of myself as an American first, a Minnesotan second, and I want to make sure that the national winner is the winner of the presidential election, notwithstanding whatever bruised egos might be involved in our state.
Thank you. Representative Winkler?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Garofalo, it's unfortunate. I was hoping you'd come in with a bill that you would actually be right on, but unfortunately we're, you know, on the opposite ends again.
Really?
You're in good company, but, you know, I don't really have a question, except to say this is, you know, the week of St. Louis Park schisms. And, you know, my view is just a little bit different, which is the times that we've had a problem with the Electoral College and the majority of vote are very, very few. We have a federal republic, and it's lots of things are set up on a state-by-state basis, as Representative Johnson alluded to. And I think, given that it's hard to identify a major problem with the current system, it seems to me that it's a more complicated way of explaining an election, to tell Minnesota voters that the candidate that Minnesota voted for is not the one that our electors are going to be voting for based on the decision of other states. And I recognize that you know, we're Americans before anything else, before we were Minnesotans, but we're still Minnesotans and we still have our own identity and our own way of doing things. And I think the Electoral College reflects that regional separation in a federal republic, and I think it's a complicated solution to a very, very small problem, and I, you know, so I don't like it, Representative Simon, and I'm sure we're going to do a lot better on the rest of the bills this session.
It is, Madam Chair, it is indeed Simon. One of the relatively rare St. Louis Park schisms. As members know, we agree on a lot. I represent the sunny, happy southern half. He represents the dour and depressing northern half of St. Louis Park, and these schisms sometimes arise, rarely, but they do, and you've seen a couple of these this week, so.
Thank you for that clarification.
I never miss an opportunity to disagree with my friend, Representative Winkler, and it's no surprise, as usual, he's wrong on this issue as he is for anything else. But I would just say from a serious standpoint that for those who take election integrity and election fraud seriously, under our current system, we have a concentration of power in very few states. And if you do analysis, it's actually very few counties within these states. And so the ability or the opportunity for fraud or for a mistake to sway a national election is statistically far more likely the more you centralize and consolidate the strength of voting power. And if you nationalize it and you have all states, all votes be at the table, you are far less likely to have that be an issue.
Thank you. President Winkler?
Well, Madam Chair, I should, of course, defend the northern half of St. Louis Park, the part that has commerce and, people and, where there's the places of St. Louis Park where any of you have ever been to. But I'm more interested in responding to Representative Garofalo because the other concern I have is the situation of a recount or a close election. I do think that essentially administering a national election where the outcome is determined on that simple vote has its own problems. And the benefit of having, I guess the point is, there's always going to be the marginal group of voters who are going to decide an election. If it's close, it's going to be close somewhere with some group in some way, and there's going to be an opportunity to figure out where you still need to move a few votes in order to win. I don't think you change any of that by doing this, but you do make the election less comprehensible to the average voter. I think at least Americans, I'll grant you, Representative Simon, we're probably not going to convince Afghanis and Iraqis about the merits of the Electoral College system, but at least Americans generally understand it, and I just think we should be hesitant to change the system that we have unless we have a fairly compelling reason for doing so.
Representative Simon.
I only have to say I don't know whether or not Americans fully understand it. I'll assume that they do, but the polling is pretty unmistakable that people support this, not only nationally, but in Minnesota, too. Now, that the poll that I have is a little bit old. It was taken in 2009. But the support was in the low 70s. So I guess that would be my response to that.
Thank you. Any other members have questions on this? Representative O'Driscoll.
I kind of enjoyed the municipal rivalry. Can you get back to that?
Representative O'Driscoll, I assume that we will have additional opportunities.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, the
Representative
St. Louis Park rivalry is nothing compared to the Civil War that's in Eagan.
Beware.
Yeah.
Representative Huntley.
Well, Madam Chair and members, coming from the northern part of the state, I guess I'm going to go with the northern part of St. Louis Park.
Any other questions on the bill? Okay. Is there anyone else from the public who wishes to be heard on this issue today? Seeing no other comments, I think that Representative Simon renews his motion that House File 799 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
No.
The motion passes. Thank you.
Thank you
for your time.
Madam Chair and members. Madam Chair, the if I may, the next bill is House File 687, and I'll move that House File 687 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Representative Simon.
Madam Chair, this is the June primary bill, and it needs not too much explanation. This would move our state primary from the current date on the second Tuesday after the second Monday in August to a couple months earlier than that. And just by way of background, we all know that as late as the 2008 election, our primary was in September. And at that point, we were tied for the second latest primary in the country. And the consequence of that, there were a lot of consequences, one of which was that for military and overseas voters, it made it a lot tougher. So the feds passed a law which basically forced our hand to change it earlier, and I think that's as it should be. But the argument when we did that in 2009 was about how much earlier to change it. I and others wanted June. Then Representative Laura Broad persuaded the governor at the time, Governor Plenty, that the best compromise would be August. We've now had a couple of primaries in August in 2010 and 2012, and the turnout has been abysmal. I don't think that's surprising. We are, what is, though, a shocking contrast is that we are, again, number one in general election turnout, and our primary turnout this last time was 9%. And you might say, well, there weren't many hot races. Well, that may be true, but it was not much better in 2010 when we really did have a hot race, especially on the DFL side for governor. So the advantages of moving the primary earlier are manyfold, I think, but one is it does make it still easier on overseas military folks, not just military, but missionary students, business people, others. It also is at a time of the year when people are going to be around to vote. August is probably the worst month in the state of Minnesota to choose in terms of an election like this. And then there's the other kind of policy advantage from my standpoint, and I think the reason why, and I know that Minority Leader Dowd isn't here, he's doing some budget stuff, but he's a strong supporter as well. And the reason that four political parties in Minnesota, the DFL, the Republican, the Libertarian, and the Independence Party, all support moving the primary to June, is because it's better for Minnesota. Sure, it's better for those parties, of course, goes without saying, but certainly better for Minnesotans to get the partisan, the intra-party squabbles out of the way earlier rather than later. I always think that it's better for Minnesotans to spend more time, not less, deciding who the best office holder would be and not who the best Democrat or Republican or Green Party member would be. So if we're voting for state auditor, why would we spend months and months up until August deciding who the best DFL or Republican auditor candidate is? Why not just spend a little bit more time deciding who the best auditor is going to be? And so, as I say, it has the support of business and civic groups and nonprofit groups. It has the support of all four of the biggest political parties in Minnesota. The bill's sort of self-explanatory. I just want to sort of preempt one of the, I think, legitimate surface-level kind of concerns about June primary, and I'm sensitive to it because we are one state. You hear from time to time that in greater Minnesota, you hear, I think it's fair to say, on a bipartisan basis, you hear some nervousness about June primary. And the rationale goes something like this. I'm embellishing only a little bit, but it basically is this. The legislator will say in so many words, look, I'm from greater Minnesota, and I'm stuck in St. Paul until the third week in May. If you have a June primary, not only will it incentivize others to run against me in a primary, but they're more likely to be successful because I basically only have a month or less to campaign by the time I get out of here in St. Paul. Meanwhile, they've spent the spring barnstorming the district, and I'm stuck here. My response to that is at least twofold. One is, if you look at other states that have very nearly the same calendar as we have, that just has not been the case. Iowa, for example, has its primary in June. Obviously, we know they have their precinct caucuses for presidential purposes earlier. They're the first in the nation. But for their statewide primaries, it's in June, and their legislative session more or less tracks ours, January or February through May. There are so few primary challenges there. I took a look at the number over the last couple of cycles, and when they are, they're nuisance candidacies, you know, the candidate who gets 8, 9, 10% of the vote. They're 90-10 affairs almost all the time. So if that gives anyone comfort, there's that. Second, I would argue that in many greater Minnesota districts, it's a double-edged sword. I mean, I'm not obviously a greater Minnesota member, but it occurs to me that when you're from greater Minnesota, you're also in the news more during that time. I come from St. Louis Park and Hopkins. The only media outlet that sort of regularly covers me, if it can even be called that, would be, you know, the Sun Sailor Community Newspaper and Patch. But if you're from greater Minnesota, very often you'll have TV, radio, daily newspapers that really cover you pretty extensively. So it seems to me that that at least offsets, maybe more than offsets, some of the perceived disadvantages. Overall, I think, though, the advantage of this is getting the intra-party stuff out of the way, making sure that all the parties can be united earlier, and that way the public is treated to a bigger and extended debate on who the best candidate is and not who the best Democrat is or who the best Republican is. That's really my pitch for the bill. It's got broad bipartisan support, and I ask for your support. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Representative Simon. Are there questions for Representative Simon at this point? I believe that, Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair and members, this is not a question, it's a comment. And, you know, I'm from the southern part of St. Louis County, so on this vote I'm going with the southern part of St. Louis Park.
Just to balance it out, Representative.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, I also have a comment, Representative Simon. I think this bill would do more for what your previous bill would do as far as getting more national attention in Minnesota. With the earlier primary, right now, the primaries are basically, for the presidential races, are over with by the time Minnesota has their primary. With this bill, moving it forward, I believe it's going to put Minnesota in play and make it more visits by presidential candidates and national candidates in Minnesota, because Minnesota will then be in play and be be more acceptable to these campaigns coming in.
Thank you. I believe that there's a person who wants to be heard on this bill, Mr. Kirk, and you can correct me on the pronunciation of your last name, but Schneidenwin.
Madam Chair, that was very good. It's complicated. I would have probably won the longest with the longest last name. Probably would have won that if they based it on that. But my name is Kirk Schneider, and I'm with the Minnesota School Boards Association. Mr. Chair has explained the issue from a partisan perspective very clearly. And I think what we're the purpose of my conversation today is explained from a school board perspective as a nonpartisan election. And I think that we've had this before our school boards from out the state at a delegate assembly to discuss this, and they just felt that the issue of a primary would create too long of a time period from when they have to pass a resolution for a primary in January, if this were to go into effect, to file in March and then have the primary in August. And so that's probably the biggest thing and the biggest concern among our members is that at the local school board level, I think it's, or at the community level, school district level, sometimes it's hard to get people engaged in running for a school board. And so by pushing it even back earlier and the filing period being in March creates a little bit of a longer window. And I can understand the argument on the for the partisan purposes. That makes sense to me. But from a local government, nonpartisan piece, we would like to see the August primary retained. So that's the big thing for us. And we right now, for school districts, have the choice about whether they want to go with an odd year or even year election. And we have seen a decrease in that over the years due to the number of complications and number of issues trying to move. So what a lot of districts have done is they've moved their elections to the even years. But we still have approximately 50 school districts out there at the local level that decide to have their elections on an odd year, so they are separate from the larger general election. And so that's another thing to consider as well, as moving that back would heighten that piece. And so I think the big thing for us, and just in summary here, is I can read who the chief author of the bill is and where this is going to go. And I think that from our perspective, I think it's important for us to understand that not all elections are partisan based, and that from a school board perspective, it's a nonpartisan issue, and it's about the people. So,
Representative Simon?
Madam Chair, just to, and that's a good point. I mean, and I respect that point about the nonpartisan races. I would only say, though, members, that even if we move to June, we will be almost exactly in the middle of the pack among states. This would not be a particularly early primary. Some states have their actual statewide and other primaries as early as February. Illinois has theirs in March. No one is saying we ought to do that. I would just say, from the standpoint of other states, I understand it would be an adjustment for folks in the nonpartisan races, that's true. But just to put it in perspective of other states, even June puts us, I think it's literally like 24th or 26th or something like that, right in the middle, or tied for such, something like that.
Thank you for your testimony. You. Representative O'Driscoll?
Mr. Schneiderland, my question is for you, sir. The 50 school districts that you said that are still on an odd year cycle, how many of those have a primary, because they don't have to by statute have a primary? So I'm just wondering if they're on what I'll call the old system.
Right.
How many of those have primaries, and is this truly an issue?
Well, Night and Wind.
Madam Chair, and I don't have that broken down between odd and even years, but I think we have between 20 and 30 districts who have chosen to pass a resolution in January, or actually, it's not in January. If this were to go into effect, would require them to pass a resolution in January, and then the filing period. And what they've actually got to do, basically, is before the filing period, they've got to pass the resolution that they're going to have a primary. So it's kind of a twisted way of doing it. But they said, we're going to establish this. We in the anticipation that we're going to need a primary beforehand, and then the filing period occurs, and then they would have to have a primary. So for the odd year people, I would say it's probably maybe anywhere from 10 to 20 in that ballpark where school districts have that issue.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess one of the things that I like about this, particularly from local nonpartisan races, is but the time of my experience over the years has been that you're looking at even a September primary and you would close your filings maybe in June or something along that line. Most people, if I could use the expression, school is out, and so they aren't thinking about school and they're not thinking about school races as well as municipal races, quite frankly. And so if you're still in an April or May time period to file, people are still kind of engaged before the weather gets too far away and people are kind of off to their activities. And then those candidates who run in the June primary have the summer and into the early fall to be able to get their message out and attend different events and things. And I don't know if there's a question there or if there's just a reaction from your experience with school boards and as much as the association bumps up against those kinds of elections.
Mr. Schneiderwind, any?
Madam Chair, I don't have anything to respond to that. I just think that from the nonpartisan side of it, from the local level, I mean, that's a great point. And I think that being, you know, having the August primary, and I feels more closely to the general election, I think that people are more heightened to that issue than moving it back to June when you have a larger gap. But I think that's a matter of semantics, perhaps, but I think that's where some of our board members were considering, is that long window is a little tough, and then you push things back and maybe not engage in the filing period as they more likely would be. So,
Representative Jespel, thank you for your testimony.
You.
Additional comments to the bill? Discussion? Is there anybody from the audience who wishes to be heard on this issue today? Ms. Frazier. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Beth Frazier with the Office of the Secretary of State. And there are just a few items I wanted to note about the bill. And one is that while cities and school districts can choose whether or not to have a primary, counties do not have that flexibility. So county candidates would have their filing period move forward. And local election officials, at least some, county auditors in particular, in smaller counties, do not only elections but also taxes. And I think that moving this time period for some counties will cause some hardships trying to juggle both tax collections and elections in more at the same time. Another item that the Secretary is concerned about is minor party candidates, and for partisan offices, minor party candidates don't have the option of just paying a filing fee. They have to collect petition signatures, and in March, there's much more likely to be inclement weather, and it may be more difficult to collect those signatures. One item I wanted to bring to your attention in terms of the bill is that this bill does not move the caucus date, and if this bill goes into effect for 2014, there would not be time next legislative session to do so. So that's a question. The caucus date right now, I believe, is February 2nd or 4th for 2014. And if you're going to move the primary up, you may want to, at the same time, move the caucus date up. That's a policy question for you all. The parties, of course, could decide to have their caucuses on a different date, but then lose the state... they're not protections, I guess they're, I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the word, benefits, the benefits provided by state law which allow for there not to be competing activities that evening and allow for inexpensive rent. So I just wanted to note that that was not in this bill. It's something you may want to consider adding, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Frazier. Any questions for Ms. Frazier? Any further discussion on the bill? And is there anyone else that wishes to be heard on this? Seeing none, Representative Simon renews his motion for House File 687 to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
And thank you, Representative Simon. Is there any additional business that we need to conduct? If not, we can adjourn the meeting as well. Thank you.